Welcome again to another episode of New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. Each program, we look at a book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author about that book. For this program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Parna Sengupta, Associate Director of Stanford's Introductory Studies Program. In her new book, Pedagogy for Religion, Missionary Education and the Fashioning of Hindus and Muslims in Bengal, she challenges the myth that Western rule secularized non-Western societies. Pedagogy for Religion focuses on missionary schools and their influence in Bengal from roughly 1850 to the 1930s. Sengupta's conclusions are drawn from reading what she calls the mundane aspects of schooling, rather than focusing on high religious discourse of religious leaders. The replications of religious, gender, and social identities, as they were established through textbooks, objects, language, and teachers, redefine modern definitions of Hindus, Muslims, and Christians. Altogether, Sengupta demonstrates that modern education effectively deepened the place of religion in colonial South Asia. However, this contemporary return to religion was not a backward or irrational resurgence of religious beliefs and practices. Religion was transformed into the carrier of modernity, and education became the means for recreating religious identity. Without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. Today we're talking with Parna Sengupta about her new book, Pedagogy for Religion, Missionary Education and the Fashioning of Hindus and Muslims in Bengal. Thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I really enjoyed your book. I think as a trained historian, you're bringing a lot to the conversation methodologically for the field of religious studies. So I'm looking forward to your input on that. And I think anyone interested in a wide variety of topics will be interested in this book. South Asia, Hindu societies, Muslim societies, religion, missionary activity. I mean, you accomplish a lot in your book. So thank you for the contribution.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into the book itself, maybe you could just tell us a bit about yourself, you know, how you got interested in missionaries, in Hindus and Muslims in South Asia, in history and religion.
Certainly. I think that, you know, there's sort of multiple ways that I came to the subject and I became interested. One is actually where I grew up. I grew up in Hawaii, and Hawaii is a place where the question of missionaries, and particularly missionary education, is actually important, quite relevant. And I myself attended what had been a missionary school, and I think that's in some ways where my interest first began. And then as an undergraduate, I had done a history honors thesis on a fairly important Scottish Presbyterian in India named Alexander Duff. And it was really through this initial reading of Duff that I started to get interested in missions more generally. And particularly in Duff, the question of, for him, the importance of English education. And so that's where I think the two issues of education, of religion, really, for me, began to come together. And I continued to do work on missionaries when I did my graduate work at the University of Michigan. And at that time, I also had the opportunity to visit some very interesting mission archives in the United States itself, including the Mennonite Archive in Goshen. And it's in actually doing some of the archival work that I saw how rich the sources were and how quite varied they were in terms of very detailed reports, but also a whole set of letters, diaries, etc. And I think as a historian, it was that richness of sources that also really interested me in terms of working with mission archives, in terms of working on missionaries themselves.
And then what drew you to this specific topic? Now, the book is roughly derived from your dissertation, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what brought you to this specific topic?
So the specific topic, when I started doing, so some people, I think, begin their research already having an answer. And so then they go and they try to find evidence for whatever it is that they want to demonstrate or prove. I think my approach was far more open-ended. So I went to the archives with some sense of the area I wanted to work on, but I really wanted to see where the sources led me. And it was in that process, in some ways, of actually looking at archival sources, of talking to also of talking to people at the archives, that is other people working on missionaries, other people working on Bengal itself, that the project began to crystallize for me. In the archives, what I found and what really interested me was what I thought was a fairly under-examined aspect of missionary work, which was really the ways that their work intersected with other kinds of educators. So missionary education, not just in India, but I would say all over the world, is one of the things that missions are most known for, that evangelicals are most known for, both Catholics and Protestants. And I think what tends not to be looked at is how influential those kinds of models, paradigms, etc. are, not just within the movement itself, but to the development of modern education and to the ideas, to the books, to the institutions developed by other educators, not just missionaries, but for example, in the case of Bengal, also upper caste Hindu educators, Muslim educators, etc.
Now, outside of the wealth of sources, why study Bengal? What exactly was special about Bengal that made you focus on that area?
So Bengal is a very, you know, it's very funny. It's almost become kind of almost a joke within South Asian studies, because Bengal has had a lot of attention focused on it in terms of history. And so there tends to be, I think, among South Asian historians, this joke about basically the overemphasis on Bengal. But in the case of my own work, I think the reason that Bengal is important, it's really one of the earliest places that Protestants develop some of their own theories, ideas, etc. But also, I think the fact that in Bengal there was such a plethora of private efforts and privatized efforts made it a very dynamic place to look at education, because it wasn't just missions, but the state as well as Hindus, Muslims, etc., many different communities who actually wanted to start their own schools. So I think it was that dynamic kind of privatized educational effort that for me made Bengal very interesting, in addition to its place symbolically, certainly within the kind of evangelical imagination, in part because of the important work of William Carey, who is seen as the kind of father of modern missions in India, and who starts his missionary activity in Serampore, which is which was at that time a colony in Bengal itself.
And why examine pedagogy? What does pedagogy reveal for us? What makes that a unique way to examine this?
I think there are probably a number of reasons. The most obvious, probably personally, is that as a teacher of history, I think about teaching itself, methods, models of teaching, etc., quite a bit. But in terms of its historical significance, the sort of front piece of my book is a page from a teacher training booklet in Bengal. And if you look at the words that appear in teacher training, I think what's very interesting is there are words that one would expect to find very narrowly connected to schooling, let's say. But then there are words that suggest the philosophical, the cultural, the other, and I would say religious kinds of aspirations that pedagogy itself had. So, for example, if you look at the front page, you not only have a word for pupil teacher, but you also have words such as dogmatic, self-love, reflection, experiment, observation, etc. And so things that really speak to much larger ideas than merely the kind of narrow ideas usually associate with schooling. And so for me, the 19th century and the 20th century, pedagogy always had aspirations far beyond teaching people how to teach or teaching people how to be in a classroom. It was really also about how we learn, how we understand the world, how we become certain kinds of subjects. And for me, increasingly, really how we become a kind of modern religious subject. That to me was what was especially interesting about sort of late 19th century, early 20th century pedagogy, is how much there's an interest in, you know, morality generally, but I would say actually religiosity even more narrowly. So that for me is what I found when I started looking at pedagogy, is that it had a much both wider influence than just schools, but also reflected larger philosophical ideas at the time, as well as spoke to the development of certain kinds of other ideas, philosophical, but also, as I look at in my book, certain ideas about gender, certain ideas about subjectivity, and certainly, of course, certain ideas about what it means to be religious or what that would entail, often articulated through pedagogy, but really speaking to something, I would say, much broader, and a conversation about something much broader than just schooling itself.
Yeah, and you do a very good job of complicating a lot of these categories, so thank you.
Thanks.
Maybe you could briefly tell us who these missionaries were. What were they doing more generally in South Asia, outside of just their educational work?
Certainly. So I think what's interesting about the 19th century for all religions, and certainly including Christianity, are the ways that that some of the definitions of what it meant to be, in this case, for example, a good Christian, really transformed. So for 19th century Protestants in Britain, which is sort of Protestant evangelicals are the group that I look at most closely, What was so important was, in fact, this idea that you suddenly had to be concerned with those who were not Christian, that part of what it meant to be a good Christian was to give money to support, and perhaps even to go abroad to help convert those who were not yet Christian. And so part of the interest in this group and the group that I look at, Protestant evangelicals, is a group that both has a lot of support back in Britain in terms of financially, but also politically, and perhaps one could say kind of morally in terms of Britain's empire. This group goes to India, many with very, I would say, lofty ambitions of conversion, most of which remain unmet. But nonetheless, India continues to be important in terms of missionaries going abroad, in part because it is, as I was saying, for Bengal, but more generally for India, symbolically so important for the British Empire. What happens to these missionaries when they get to India is they find a situation where it's actually quite difficult to convert. And even though they hope that schools are one institution where they will be able to do it, they are constantly frustrated in various ways at their conversion efforts. Some of the other things that they do in addition to educating or starting schools is doing itinerant preaching, starting up various kinds of publications, writing dictionaries for languages that did not have dictionaries previously, doing a lot of the kinds of work that then becomes the kinds of both institutions but also publications that then also become important more generally for Indian society. And what missionaries find over the 19th century is while they at one point had, for example, dominated something like printing, that dominance really recedes and decreases over that period of time. So all of these things, itinerant preaching, writing or translation, teaching, all of these are connected. One of the other reasons that I think missionaries are quite interesting in this period is that while initially it starts out with men, primarily men who go over, especially in the field of education, what you see through the 19th century, and by the time you come to the late 19th century, this is certainly the case, more and more women missionaries going abroad, both individuals who are married to male missionaries, but also single women who go abroad to be teachers, who go abroad and start schools. And so for me, this was also a very interesting kind of group to look at in terms of the development and change of, for instance, gender relations in Britain and also in India.
Now, one of the methods that you use that I think makes your study very unique is you focus on what you call the mundane aspects of schooling. So what do you mean by this term exactly, and why do you feel like this is an effective approach?
Certainly. So I think that when we talk about transformations in society or changes in society at the level of ideas and of practice, when we talk of ideas, we tend to just look at the very big ideas or the kind of high theory changes that happen. But part of what interests me about pedagogy itself, it's this kind of funny mid-level theory that speaks to practice. It's purpose, that is pedagogic theory's purpose, ideas of teacher training or how to write a language primer or how to start a school are directly kind of concerned with very practical issues. But at the level of ideas, it has very kind of large aspirations. And the reason I think these mundane aspects are important is because many of the kind of larger philosophical, religious changes that may or may not be happening actually get enacted through and rethought, retranslated, reconstituted at the level of things like how you should teach or how you should set up a school or how you might want to write a language primer. I think that these kinds of objects don't tend to be studied in that way. Instead, you have either highly kind of bureaucratic ways of understanding education, you know, X number of schools and this person was the principal or this person was the teacher, or you have a look at more general statements about this is what the British Empire should be doing for its subjects, etc. So when we talk about the civilizing mission, there tends to be a look at the broader or larger sorts of ideas, but very little looking at actually pedagogically, literally pedagogically, how something like civilization is supposed to be enacted, is supposed to be apprehended, is supposed to be understood. And so for me, those kinds of what I call mundane aspects become very, very rich for bringing together ideas and practice in terms of this historical moment.
Another innovative step I think you take in your methodology is you look at the dialogical relationship between the missionary educators and the local leaders. So maybe you could mention how this approach complicates previous studies or adds to that, and what maybe this relationship between missionaries and locals was.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I think has really been sort of an issue within in the study of missions is that it continues to be understood in very binary ways. And by that I mean, you know, missionaries equals imperialism. And then there is this undifferentiated category, which are the natives. So it's missionaries against natives or something like that. This, of course, is absolutely not the case. And there's been very important work, I think, looking at, you know, what a much earlier book had called The Tensions of Empire, the ways, for example, missionaries were at times very much in tension with and at times directly at odds with other imperial actors. But on the other side, what I was interested in is really complicating this notion of a native opinion or a native set of schools or a native way of doing things. This is simply not the case. And I think in all societies, it's far more complicated by not just multiple traditions, but also all kinds of forms of hierarchy within, in this case, Indian society and Indian culture. And so when I started doing my work, I was very attentive to the fact that, for example, some of the early translations of teacher training books were not just done by Indians, but were really done by a certain group, largely upper caste Hindu Bengalis who worked for the Department of Public Instruction. And in that process of translation, they did not create a Indian form, let's say, of teacher training. They really created a form of teacher training that reflected their particular community set of concerns, set of cultural reference, etc. And I think in India, this is very clear in part because this is actually then later in the 19th century, directly criticized by lower caste groups, by non-Hindus, particularly by Muslim educators. And so you see the way that it's absolutely untenable, this idea of missionaries and native, for example, that the native is a very is a highly differentiated category, and that missionaries themselves, amongst themselves, but also in their relationship to other imperial bodies, including the East India Company itself, and then later the British Raj, that missionaries themselves were not always completely in alignment. And so in looking at local leaders, I really wanted to show the complexity of that, not just to show complexity, but because it actually creates this very dynamic situation. And the situation in which ideas of culture or the reproduction of certain forms of either culture or religion is directly contested by other communities, by other groups within Indian society.
Now, kind of getting to some of the meat of some of the chapters, you begin by kind of giving us an overview of some forms of education in South mm-hmm. Asia during the 19th century. Maybe you could mm-hmm. Describe some of these forms. So you have religious education, you have vernacular mm-hmm. education, you have mm-hmm. mass education. Mm-hmm. What do these look like?
Certainly. So, there were, before sort of the development of what we consider modern schooling, there were, as you were saying, there were multiple forms of various ways of kind of formal education for in India. There were village schools, which were called bachalas, and these schools were often supported locally by the village or by a prominent landholder who would give money to these schools in order to educate, usually primarily boys, sometimes girls, and primarily from certain kinds of literate castes. But there were also religious schools that offered much more specialized kinds of instruction. These were not mass schools in the sense that everyone was expected to go to them. But there was some idea that if you wanted to go, for example, if you wanted more specific training within certain kinds of Muslim subjects, you might go to a maktab, you might go to a Quran school. But they were never meant to be mass schools. The closest thing to a mass school or a kind of mass education really was this bachala. There were also, much higher forms of learning as well. In the 19th century, you see a transformation of all of these forms. The British Empire, unlike some of the other empires, and certainly very different than the United States, was not that interested in creating a single state-run system, in part because that didn't exist in Britain either. Instead, what they hoped was to modernize these various kinds of village schools or certain kinds of religious institutions to make all of them look more like what they considered the kind of model modern school, which I argued was very much shaped by the mission ideal itself. And so it was these efforts to transform these other schools that that I look at, but also what continued into the 20th century is this a huge amount of variation in the kinds of schools available to different communities, the kinds of schools available in different areas, and the different kind of resources available to, for example, a village school versus a school that might be set up with some government funding, which would be in more urban areas, for instance. So the kind of pre-colonial differentiation you saw, variation you saw, actually continued into the colonial period, although the schools themselves went through some dramatic transformation. But nonetheless, you had really very different kinds of educational institutions that that were meant to serve very different kinds of communities and needs.
You then move into the relationship between language and religious identity. I'm wondering, you talk a lot about the practice of reading and the idea of literacy. And I'm wondering if you could kind of explain the role of literacy. It seems that there's different opinions on this from the perspective of Bengalis and the perspective of the missionaries. So what is the role of literacy?
Certainly. So I would say, you know, the idea of reading is very central to not just evangelical pedagogy, but I would say evangelical Protestantism itself. The idea of either silently reading the Bible or, you know, reading in a kind of Bible study kind of environment, but the idea of having direct access to the Word of God is very central and very important. And this means that when missionaries and evangelicals set up schools, for them, reading becomes one of the central things that they're concerned about, literacy. And for many missionaries, they're not that concerned that the literacy be in English. They're more concerned, and they feel that they would be more successful if the literacy was in a native language, in this case, Bengali, and that therefore students would be able to read the Bengali Bible. This is true all over the world of missionaries more generally. In terms of the place of literacy within Indian society, literacy was, you know, available just as it was for a long time in Europe and only beginning to change in the 19th century, was really available only to a very small group of people. And within what we might think of as caste Hinduism itself, there were very clear strictures about who was allowed to be literate, who wasn't. There were all kinds of anxieties, for example, about women's literacy and what kinds of sort of changes in society that might lead to. There was explicit kinds of injunctions against lower caste and untouchable groups ever having access to literacy. So literacy in Hindu society, just as it is in many other societies, was a way to ensure the reproduction of certain kinds of hierarchies and differences. For evangelicals, literacy is always meant to be mass. Everyone should learn to read. And in their own schools that they start in Britain, this is very much what they want to do. In setting up schools, especially, you know, non-Anglican schools in Britain, for example, they're very much concerned to expand the group that has access to literacy precisely so people can read the Bible. And it's this idea, and I would say this is really part of the kind of what I see as the kind of interesting and radical edge of evangelicalism, which is this idea of mass literacy, of mass education, of reaching everyone, and of everyone having direct access to that kind of schooling. So you don't necessarily need someone to serve as an intermediary between you and, for evangelicals, the Word of God, for example. And it's this that I think really is very much a part of their efforts to start schools, their efforts to translate books into Bengali languages, to write into Bengali as one of the languages they translate into, as well as to produce, you know, lots of cheap material written in the vernacular in Bengali itself. This from the kind of I would say kind of caste Hindu side, there's quite a bit of discomfort with that. And so part of, you know, within, I think, the colonial context, part of what made modern education worth having, or part of what made it worth going to a school, a modern school that was partially, that might be missionary, that might be partially funded by the government, was precisely its exclusivity. So there was a desire to keep education as something that exclusively certain communities, certain groups had access to, and to, in fact, maintain that kind of hierarchy through schooling. And so the modern of modern education, I think, is both something that, For some people, what makes it worth having is that other people can't have it. For others, the modern of modern education is a possibility that everyone would have access to it. And I think that's the kind of tension you see in terms of the funding, in terms of the ideas of the kinds of books that should be available, the kinds of schools, where those schools should be located, etc. And so I think these are some of the ideas around literacy, particularly that really speak, I think, to ideas both of religion, but also of hierarchy within communities.
In this section, you talk about textbooks a lot. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between language, textbooks, and then the formation of religious identity in this time?
So one of the things that I think I really became interested in this chapter was when people tend to think about missionary work in other parts of the world, and in fact in this kind of if you read some of the books on missionaries in terms of their imperial aspirations, it's often seen that other religions react to missionaries. So, you know, evangelicals or Christians introduce certain kinds of ideas, other groups, other communities, Hindus, Muslims, etc., react to and their own ideas change. What I was interested in looking at in this chapter was actually how evangelical ideas began to change in interaction with other communities. In the case of the textbook itself, so there was this controversy over what kind of Bengali textbook to use. The most popular textbook, which is a book called Varnaparichay, was written by a very important educator and reformer named Vidyasagar. And Vidyasagar was very, he was interested in modernizing Bengali, but in that kind of modernizing of it, the Bengali that he, and the Bengali textbooks that he created, the language primers he created, really reflected a very much his background, which was as a scholar of Sanskrit, as an upper caste Hindu scholar. And so these books tended to have words that were highly Sanskritized. These were not necessarily the way that ordinary people spoke. There were many different kinds of spoken Bengalis in all over this area, but this was a very particular form that spoke to his own background. In spite of the sort of rarefied kind of Bengali that he offered, it was nonetheless a modern prose Bengali and was really widely picked up. It became a very popular reader in Bengali schools. Many of them run by Hindu educators as well. What ended up happening, however, is that missionary schools began to use these books. And among missionaries, there was a debate about whether or not it was appropriate to use the reader written by a non-Christian to teach in a Christian school. Part of the issue that was raised was, of course, the nature of the Bengali that was being taught, that it was very Sanskritized, the words were difficult, it took a long time to learn, etc. But the other piece of it was that how is it, you know, isn't there a problem if the person that you're learning to read from or the book that you're learning to read from is not imbued with explicitly Christian moral tales, Christian words, Christian lessons, etc. And so what we see here and what I found very interesting was the way that this book actually forced a kind of conversation among missionaries themselves. And I would say, you know, kind of was a part of the shift that was happening in Britain as well, which is where people actually talked about being able to disengage or disconnect the religious identity of a person writing a book and even the religious content of a book from the teaching of letters or the teaching of sentence structure, etc. And so what you see is this kind of what we would call a kind of secularizing process, but one that in this context was really created by the situation of, in fact, Vidyasagar writing this very popular book that displaced other missionary language primers. And so that was, you know, so there was this kind of that for me was this very interesting moment in the way that evangelicals themselves had to rethink what it meant to teach language, but also really whether or not it was possible to separate out religion as a subject from the teaching of language as a subject. And this is important not just for schooling, but I think in terms of when one starts thinking about more generally whether or not you can be, you know, a secular person in one aspect and just have religion in another aspect. And so that in part was really my interest in this language primer controversy.
Another pedagogical technique that was used were object lessons. So these are kind of new to me. So maybe you could explain what these object lessons are. And then explain how they were used by missionaries and then how they were adapted by the Bengalis.
Certainly. So object lessons, the idea of the object lesson, which really sort of very early on gets its first kind of articulation in the work of a very radical, I'd say a very radical educator, Pestalozzi, was the idea that one should learn not from books, that is small children should learn ideas not from books but from objects, and for Pestalozzi particularly objects in nature, objects outside, and it is through working with objects, working with natural things that children would start to develop abstract ideas of things like counting, color, form, etc. And for Pestalozzi, his interest in it was that he was very interested in kind of radically expanding the possibilities of education. So not just the European elite, in his case, kind of the Swiss elite got education, but really ordinary children would also be able to be taught. And he saw kind of object teaching moving away from books as one way to sort of reach a larger group, but also as a pedagogy that that was far less didactic, that offered a kind of open-endedness if children themselves were allowed to handle objects. What happens is this technique that has this, I would say, rather radical and very interesting kind of orientation, when it gets picked up and popularized by missionaries, in fact, becomes a book again. So rather than handling objects, the children are taught to use objects as they are pictured in books. And this goes back to this kind of evangelical interest in literacy more generally. Part of that shift, of course, is that the kind of non-didactic nature of having just an object that you handle really changes, so that instead almost all of the objects become framed by basically what are almost catechistical kind of questions about how to apprehend or understand the object. That is, rather than a student a child coming to an understanding of the object and a set of abstract ideas, now they are being guided and sometimes explicitly told how they should understand this object. Moreover, by moving it away from objects themselves, these object lesson books, these evangelical object lesson books, began to be filled with what I call objects of empire, things like pepper, for example, or rice, things that an ordinary British school child might not otherwise ever come into contact with, but suddenly would find in an object lesson book, and that object would be used to teach something, in fact, about the imperial or the colonial place that that it had come from. This method actually becomes very popular among Indians themselves, and there are a number of object lesson books that become written. Some of them direct translations, some of them sort of loosely based on other object lessons. But the books that get translated are not the evangelical books, and the purpose of them is less about teaching certain particular ideas of empire. Instead, the books that really become translated are books about science, and so they're scientific objects or scientific knowledge through objects that become popularly that you find in these Bengali school books. But even there, just as in the evangelical books, they were very much framed by a set of kind of didactic question and answers. In the Bengali books also, what I look at is the ways that they again become framed by certain kinds of sort of didactic ideas, as well as certain kinds of assumptions about culture, about religion. One example of this is actually rice. So rice appears in a number of different object lesson books. In a very early evangelical book, in David Stowe's book, what you have in the object lesson about rice, rice is seen to stand in for certain qualities of rice-eating peoples, qualities that are not that positive, that are about being, you know, kind of lazy or being not as, you know, in highly gendered language, basically not as manly as those that might be perhaps bread eating. That rice lesson within the Bengali book gets changed completely. And so instead you have, on the one hand, slightly more attention paid to how rice is grown, how it is cultivated. But you also have a discussion, and this is what I found interesting, of the different uses of rice. But in discussing the different uses of rice, there's actually one of the uses is specifically about a particular religious ceremony or a puja. And so the assumption there is that for those reading that object lesson on rice, they would know that religious ceremony, that they would be connected somehow. And so you have a whole, you know, it's a different set of cultural ideas, but there are still a set of cultural ideas connected to this object called rice. But very different and very differently configured than you have in the evangelical books. And what I'm interested in, kind of in a more general sense with object lessons, is that it then serves paradoxically as a kind of metaphor for religious, kind of the evolution of religious thinking itself. So if objects are used to teach abstract thinking, there is a kind of explicit discussion about the way that that movement from the concrete to the abstract is precisely the movement that missionaries hope or evangelicals hope that other religious traditions will move. And in fact, the closer you are to objects as in your religious practice or understanding of your religious practice, the further you're seen from Christianity, the further you're seen from the possibility of abstraction or abstract thought. So Christianity becomes the example of abstraction or abstract thought, and you know, fetishism or use of fetishes or animism are seen as examples of the kind of concrete, almost childlike relationship to religion through objects. And so there are multiple ways that I see this object, the object lesson working in terms of cultural and religious ideas, but also as a metaphor for itself, for a kind of evolution of religious thinking that is very much you know, evolutionarily understood through the movement from childlike to more adult forms of thinking, of abstract thinking and abstraction.
Yeah, I found that a very convincing argument, how you use these object lessons to show how missionaries were trying to get Hindus away from the anthropomorphizing of icons and idols. Mm-hmm. So very good chapter. I like that a lot. In chapters 4 and 5, you talk a lot about gender. You talk mm-hmm. about the roles, kind of the shaping of Bengali notions of masculinity, mm-hmm. Of femininity. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can talk about the role of the teacher in these kind of gendered behaviors that are being shaped.
Certainly. So one of the things that I found very interesting in looking at the formal training of teachers was the ways that ideas of what it meant to be an effective teacher, the ways that they were kind of formally laid out, written up in both missionary and later some of the Bengali books, is the ways that they also had a whole set of ideas of the teacher being a kind of ideal example of a certain kind of man, a certain kind of, you know, either not just metaphors, but literally being a father, or literally the kinds of relationships a student should have to a teacher should be what the modern child-to-parent relationship should look like. And so I really saw teacher training as being about much more than the training of teachers, but really the training of certain kinds of models of behavior. But particularly in the case of, you know, so one chapter deals with male teachers, in the case of male teachers, very much models of fathering and fatherhood and masculinity. With women teachers, they run into a problem in India, not just in India, in Britain one sees a different problem, but what's interesting is that in India it's actually very hard to find women teachers. Strictures of both upper caste Hindu society as well as upper class Muslim society make it very difficult for women to work as teachers, to move around, to have that kind of public position. And so there are various efforts to introduce first of all, by the Department of Education, kind of lower caste women and not, you know, what are called Bairagi or Vaishnava women as teachers. This fails because there's so much resistance to seeing these women as respectable. They're already seen as non-respectable because they tend to be single or widowed. They tend to belong to religious groups that are not seen as really as truly moral or respectable. And so instead, what the majority of teachers that you find, women teachers that you find in India, really come from missionary training schools. And so you have a number of native Christians who become teachers. And while many of them are lower caste and therefore, you know, really not totally acceptable by many upper caste homes or upper caste society, the fact of their Christian training, the fact that they work in mission schools, means that they're able to set themselves up as teachers. And over time, teaching becomes very closely associated, in fact, with missionaries and mission teachers. You don't have the same problem with male teachers because there is a longer tradition of men being teachers. And so it's not just, you know, native Christian men who become teachers, but many Hindu men, Muslim men, etc., who also become teachers. But in that training, they're expected not just to be a good teacher, but a model for a particular kind of father, a model for a particular kind of modern man.
In the final chapter, we find out in 1872 there's a census which reveals that that Muslims make almost half the population. But they're grossly underrepresented. So after 1872, how does this affect changes in educational resources?
Mm-hmm. So after the census is taken, and it's not just about the census, there's sort of other changes happening in Bengal and in India more generally, that there is a concerted effort by the colonial government to put resources directly into Muslim education. Again, the question becomes, well, should the state set up its own set of schools to educate Muslim communities? And it's decided instead of doing that, the state will help fund already pre-existing schools, Muslim schools. There are a number of issues institutionally, as well as logistically in terms of this decision. First of all, by this period, it's not just that there are many more Hindu schools, but the Department of Public Instruction itself, it has far more Hindu. In fact, there are very few Muslims who are, you know, inspectors or teachers or anything within the department. So there's a need before, you know, in addition to starting these schools, there's a need actually to have inspectors, to have more of a Muslim presence within the Department of Public Instruction itself. It's also the Pachala or the village school. It comes to be seen as a Hindu school, even though, you know, it's really supposed to be a village school. And so instead, the department decides, rather than using the Pachala or the village school as a school for all Bengalis, Hindus, Muslims, whatever, instead they'll put money into Quran schools, which are lower level Muslim schools that are supposed to teach kind of basic literacy, as well as, you know, what's hoped is some of the more modern kinds of subjects. What I was interested in looking at this is that the Department of Public Instruction keeps saying over and over again that what they want is to modernize schooling. They want to add more secular material into already existing Muslim schools. Part of the reason for this is that even as the state recognizes that they have hugely underfunded Muslim education, there is this kind of anxiety or fear about the excessive religiosity of Muslims. And this very much has to do with the way that the colonial state comes to kind of apprehend or understand, one could say stereotype, Hindus and Muslims, also because there is a fear of kind of peasant uprisings that will be led by Muslim leaders, for example. And so there's a desire to kind of tamper down on what's seen as the excessive religiosity of Muslims through, for example, schooling. But what I find paradoxically is that the way they're going to do that is to expand religious schooling itself. Moreover, in the efforts to expand or to modernize Muslim schooling, what I show is the ways that the colonial state, in spite of saying that it is indifferent or neutral to the question of religious education, actually ends up shaping the way that much of the religious content itself is delivered. And what I mean, kind of an example of this is actually going back to this question of literacy, is, for example, the re-emphasis on literacy and books. So within a number of Quran schools and within kind of Muslim education more generally, there is a lot of the, as well as within Hindu education, it's not anything that's specific to Muslim education, there is a lot of emphasis on various forms of oral literacy, of learning things by heart, of being, of recitation, etc. This is now seen as pedagogically backward. And instead, it is, in order to be a modern school, one must have books that will teach you the same things that previously you may have learned in an oral context. In that emphasis on books, on book learning, and a real effort to marginalize other forms of oral literacy, what I see is, you know, an effort to kind of to introduce that evangelical emphasis on literacy, on the book, as the primary way to become a modern religious subject. For evangelicals, of course, it's reading the Bible. But in this case, the idea is that to be a good modern Muslim school, your students should be reading the Quran, not merely learning it by heart. And so this effort to change pedagogy, I argue, should also be seen actually as an effort to change some of the practice itself, some of the kind of, as I had described, a kind of ordinary or sort of mundane way that that the definition of what it means to be educated as a Muslim or learn Muslim knowledge actually ends up being shaped by these demands that are ostensibly pedagogic. So that's sort of in that chapter, my interest is in how, in trying to reform or modernize these schools. In fact, there are all these efforts to introduce pedagogic ideas that change the content, but also the form in which religious knowledge is conveyed.
Well, Parna, we've taken up a lot of your time. Very interesting to talk to you. The book, again, I really thought was very, very good, well-researched, very dynamic in the ways you're approaching your sources, and I think you're adding a lot to the conversation. So hopefully you'll get some wide readership. Before I let you go, though, would you mind telling us about what kind of things you're working on now?
Certainly. What I'm working on right now is something that seems so completely different from this book, but is connected, in fact, precisely in this question of, I think, the relationship between sort of religion and transformation. I'm working on astrology and a project on astrological almanacs and the practice of astrology more generally. I'm interested in the fact that astrology continues to be very important in modern India, and important not just for religious functions, but in fact in making lots of different kinds of decisions about business, about one's personal life, etc. And so I'm really interested in what happens to astrology over the 19th and 20th century in India, how it becomes connected to things that we see as very modern, like the marketplace. And so that's what my new project is about.
Great. Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Well, thank you again. We really enjoy talking to you and appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And that was my interview with Parnasen Gupta about her wonderful new book, Pedagogy for Religion, Missionary Education and the Fashioning of Hindus and Muslims in Bengal, out on University of California Press this year. Thanks for listening.